And we'll move to the last case. United States versus Smith. Mr. Stevens.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning.
In this case, we are asking you to define how much wiggle room Judge Sharp has when considering the factors in 3553. I believe from this record you can conclude that the district court felt that its discretion under 3553 was restricted. And the fact that the district court invited briefs and the scope of discretion, said that time would be given for those briefs, but then went ahead and entered judgment, truncated the process.
Do you know, Mr. Stevens, if Judge Sharp uses this system in other cases?
He has used the system of filing a sentencing memorandum on the day of sentencing. Not filing it, but presenting it to counsel. And it is usually accompanied by a caveat, which appears in this record, that it's not final and he will hear allocution and so forth. But
and then does he ask for more papers after he's given the sentence?
No, usually not.
So this was a first in your experience?
Yes. As far as asking for additional briefs,
uh-huh.
And I will say that many of the cases in the Northern District of Indiana are done on the basis of plea agreements, which contain a waiver of appeal rights. In this instance, Mr. Smith pled guilty to both counts without the benefit of a plea agreement. So this was a situation where Mr. Smith's appellate rights were preserved, and I think the court was obviously aware of that fact. But I am still mystified by why the court would, on the one hand, say I'm going to give you more time to expand this and to get additional authority, invited a very thorough brief. He said, I'm not going to just take a recitation of the language from Booker, but I want language from the Seventh Circuit on the scope of the district court's discretion. And I was prepared to do it. I wasn't prepared to do it within 7 days. But
it would have been a meaningless act, Mr. Stevens. He had already pronounced sentence.
But he didn't. And he'd filed a memorandum which he said was tentative, and then during the course of the colloquy said he was willing to consider other things. But what cut off the inquiry was, in this instance, he did not in fact impose a sentence. There was a judgment order that was entered after the hearing. Ordinarily the district court will say, this is the sentence I propose, and do you know of any reason other than the objections that have already been stated as to why that sentence should not be imposed? And at this time, and then everybody says no, and then the district court says, well, I commit you to the custody of the Bureau of Prisons for 12 months and a day, and the other conditions that go along with that. And then it's announced in open court pursuant to the statute. And we cited the statute in the brief that says you state, impose a sentence in open court and state the reasons therefore.
Do you think there was let's say, sort of an actual discussion of the issues here? Was there that?
There was fresh information that was presented at the sentencing hearing. Mr. Smith talked about the murder of his stepson and a carjacking that he was a victim of, which were part of his explanation about why he possessed the firearms. But I believe that some of that may have been alluded to in my sentencing memorandum, but it was certainly was not presented in the same detail as Mr. Smith presented in his oral statement during allocution. And there was fresh information that was presented. That is clear.
But the court did not fail to take that into consideration. The judge sat there and listened to it and nevertheless imposed the sentence that was specified in the memorandum that he supplied. So I don't understand your argument to be that that information was not considered or that the sentence that was imposed is unreasonable because it was not considered. You're not attacking the sentence that was imposed.
The argument is not that the sentence was unreasonable. The argument is that the district court failed to apprehend the scope of his discretion.
Yeah.
And was calling for information about the scope of the discretion. And until the rules by which it's going to be evaluated are settled, you cannot say that it has been considered in accordance with those rules.
Well, the district court said on repeated occasions, both from the bench and in the memorandum that he submitted to the parties, that he understood that he had the discretion to issue a below-guidelines sentence. That much is clear. So the judge plainly understood that he was in a post-Booker world. This isn't a Palladino situation. That he had the discretion to impose a below-guidelines sentence. He was looking for a way to do that so that it would stick in the face of a government appeal. That's how I read this transcript. And he employed this highly unorthodox and, in fact, illegal procedure to invite arguments after the imposition of sentence about how he might make a below-guideline sentence stick when, in fact, that's not what he was imposing. That's how I read this. Why is that an improper interpretation of what was going on?
Because the sentence was not, in fact, imposed in open court. He gave the impression that he was withholding judgment to ascertain the criterion which should be applied. And until that criterion is established, it seems to me that the sentence should be vacated.
Well, he actually did impose sentence on the day of the sentencing hearing. That's at page 15 of the transcript.
He said, "I'm going to enter the sentence that is proposed in the memorandum."
Right.
I do not take that to be the equivalent of the statutory requirement of actually imposing a sentence in open court. I mean,
the way that it's happened in
over 40 years of experience is that that the judge says how much time you're going to serve. That's what happens.
Does the statute require that?
Yes.
The statute requires that certain magic words be spoken?
Not magic words, but the
I mean, it's in the memorandum, right?
18 U.S.C. 3553C provides the court at the time of sentencing shall state in open court the reasons for its imposition of the particular sentence. And I read that as requiring a number of months and a statement of reasons.
That was in the memorandum, right, which was of record?
No. There was something in the memorandum. There was text in the memorandum. Nothing was stated on the record in open court to provide with 3553C.
Is Mr. Smith serving this sentence?
Yes.
Yes, right. I remember now. Okay.
Yeah.
I think he's in Ashland, Kentucky.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Barrett.
Thank you. Jesse Barrett for the United States, Your Honors. I think it is important to clarify that what opposing counsel started out saying that this appeal was about is not, in fact, what this appeal is about. Opposing counsel represented that it was for this court here to determine the amount of wiggle room that a sentencing judge has in under Section 3553 in a post-Booker world. But that's actually not what the appellant requests in the brief. What Mr. Smith requests is a determination of whether the judge followed the right procedural system.
Well, he didn't, did he?
It was odd.
Yeah, and he's such a, you know, experienced and great judge and one of my favorite humans that I wonder, you know, it's pretty obvious he had a lot of sympathy for Mr. Smith, isn't it?
I think he did, and
yeah.
I think Mr. Smith was a sympathetic defendant as opposed to some of the defendants who come, you know, before his court. It was certainly an odd system.
See, if you read the transcript from the sentencing hearing, I for one got the feeling that Judge Sharp did not recognize his authority to sentence below the guideline range. That's just the feeling I have after reading it all. And of course, he has that authority now.
Well, and he expressed...
So let's all go home.
He did express in the sentencing memorandum, which he explicitly entered in open court as the judgment of the court, that he recognized the discretion he had, but he was choosing not to exercise that discretion because of the circumstances of Mr. Smith's criminal history and because of the circumstances of the crime.
So you think he did recognize his authority to sentence below?
It is certainly the case that in his comments at the sentencing, he expressed dissatisfaction with the sentencing guidelines and the post-sentencing guidelines framework. And I think he made the statement that, you know, he's reviewed every slip opinion that comes down from this court, and he hasn't been able to find one in which a below-guideline sentence is upheld.
Well,
so he certainly did make those statements.
Yeah. Well, that wasn't right, was it?
I don't think it was quite right.
Right.
But it is the case that in his sentencing memorandum, he recites the law as it exists, and he recognizes his discretion as it exists.
I know, but... You know, I mean.
But what would happen if it goes back? Is he going to give the same sentence? Is that a probable result? Or is he going to do something different? Or because we have to try to frame something, either with affirming or sending back or something, to frame this so the way it ought to be, as opposed to what happened.
It seems to me it's probable, based on the record, that Mr. Smith would get the same sentence, because about 10 days after the judge imposed sentence, he issued a further memorandum and order stating that upon further consideration of his sentencing memorandum and the events at sentencing, he decided to impose the same sentence. So he actually did go back, apparently, and look at it.
But wouldn't you be more comfortable if this were remanded? I mean, wouldn't the government feel more comfortable about the... I mean, when you look at this globally, this whole whatever, you know, went on here, wouldn't the government feel more comfortable and more secure? And
I don't think the government would. It could be that the defendant would. It seems to me pretty apparent from the sentencing memorandum, from Judge Sharp's subsequent reconsideration of the subsequent memorandum, of the sentencing memorandum and the sentence imposed, that the sentence he decided to impose is the sentence that he wanted to impose.
But we don't know that 100%, do we?
Well, I think we're about as close as we can be, because...
99?
Maybe 99.9.
Is that good enough in this, in the world of...
Well, the judge did everything he was required to do under Booker. I mean, under the law of the Seventh Circuit, the way the Seventh Circuit has interpreted Booker and these post-Booker case law, he did everything procedurally that he had to do. He just added the quirk of telling the defendant, if you want to, I'm going to enter this sentence, this is my sentence. The defendant asked him to withhold imposition of the sentence.
My sentence is 1 year and a day. He never said that, did he?
He wrote that in the sentencing memorandum.
I know, but he never said it. I mean, we don't have mute judges.
He did not repeat the words that were in the sentencing memorandum, but he did say he was entering the sentence in the sentencing memorandum.
I can tell you this is the first time in my 40 years of judge, prosecutor, heaven only knows what else I've been, that I've ever seen a judge not in open court say your sentence is.
And I've only been with the U.S. Attorney's Office for under a year, so I don't have that experience to say, but it based on...
I'll see in 39 years.
Based on the case law applying the open court requirement of Section 3553, no court has found that there is a requirement that the judge say you have to state orally the amount of time imposed. To the contrary, courts have said... Basically, and these cases are cited in the brief, that what's in the memorandum is generally sufficient as long as that memorandum is filed and the court is imposing the sentence which is in the memorandum. So I think that although it was a little bit of an awkward situation, it's certainly not reversible, and it's actually in compliance with the best case law that's out there on the point.
I'm going to have to look at that, but it seems a bit... It would seem odd to me if that were the case.
And I guess
I mean,
maybe...
the old if you go way back to the old English law, they had to pronounce. So I don't know. I'll take your word for it right now, but I'm wondering.
And I guess it would come back to Judge Mannion's question of if the court were to reverse and remand for sentencing, would the order be, the court is required to state orally on the record the sentence that it already wrote in the sentencing memorandum. I mean, I guess that would be the remedy, although it's hard to see what that would serve.
It's sort of more than that. It just is, everything seems a bit confused here.
Certainly it is an odd situation.
Yeah.
But what we don't want to happen is we don't want this to happen again, regardless of what we do here.
That's correct.
I think the question, I guess, is how, and we'll have to figure that out, is how to frame it one way or the other, so that we caution everybody, the attorneys and judges and others, that this is not the way to do it. Even though we can have a sympathetic figure being sentenced, we can't just lament about it and make sympathy or something. Maybe it makes you feel better to say, gee, I really feel bad, but I got to do this. I don't know. But unlike these two, I've never sentenced anybody. And I've always been sympathetic to the fact that judges say this is the hardest thing to do. And I understand that. And this was a tough one, obviously. I think the fact that the second trip with the gun, I guess to his mother's or something, it was
loaded. He represented at sentencing that he was returning the gun to his mother's home. And it was loaded.
Yeah. And, he sort of wince at that a little bit, and he's done lots of good things in the community and that sort of thing. So there's a, as you say, this is a lot better than a lot of them. Maybe you said that. Whoever said it, it's better than a lot of people who we look at. But this is still a situation that has to be sorted out, and it's not made easier by what happened down there.
Mr. Barrett, why didn't you object to this unorthodox procedure and get the record clarified when you had the opportunity? I mean, most of this, if not all of it, could have been avoided if counsel for both sides would have made it clear to Judge Sharp what's clear to everybody in this room, that what he was doing is, at least this post-imposition of sentencing, holding the matter open for 90 days and inviting briefs to get him to change his mind, was illegal, and that he needed to make his decision clearer.
Two answers. One, I think that I was certainly caught off guard by this proposal, but In fact, opposing counsel, who obviously also was counsel below, when the judge proposed to do this procedure, requested the judge not to impose that sentence because, you know, once a sentence is imposed within 7 days, it becomes final and it can't be corrected. And the judge said, essentially, no, that is what I'm going to do. Certainly, in hindsight, I should have objected and say, you know, Your Honor, actually, you really can't do that.
You'll be able to do that in the next 39 years. It's
that's
hard
right.
When you're new.
If there are no further questions, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you have anything to add, Mr. Barrett? I'm sorry, Ed Stevens.
I'll add more if you want.
I need 39 more years to get it right.
Okay, thank you. I think the way to find out whether the sentence would be the same after full consideration of the scope of his discretion is to reverse and remand this sentence and clarify exactly what should be done. And as far as the cases, which I believe counsel refers on page 18 of his brief, at the United States versus Carey, there's an incorporation by reference of the reasons in a sentencing memorandum, but in that case, sentence was imposed in open court, and I think that's the universal practice. Yeah. I think those are the only two things I have to say.
Okay, that completes the argument of the day. Yeah, you were court appointed.
Yes,
I appreciate the fine work you did for your client under these circumstances. That completes the arguments for the day. The court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.